From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Our connection for this hour was made several years ago in Rochester when a chef named Jeff Caruso moved to town. Jeff had built a colorful career in the restaurant kitchens of Manhattan, the Hudson Valley, and more. And if he was coming to Rochester to retire, it turns out he picked the wrong town, because Jeff was about to embark on a different kind of cooking career. He was going to work with a food kitchen. Within months, Caruso's cooking for A Meal and More turned this operation into one of high demand. People who weren't in need of food began showing up anyway, offering donations for a chance to taste his dishes. Jeff has a new book out. A Meal and More also has a book of recipes that you can get. And this conversation is part of our Summer of Food series of discussions about the food scene in Rochester and the Finger Lakes. You can find previous Summer of Food conversations on the Connections podcast page. My guests include Jeff Caruso, of course. Jeff is the author of Oi Italia. He's the chef and kitchen manager for A Meal and More. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
We've got a lot to talk about. You've got a lot of stories to tell.
Well, yes, I do.
So we're going to be getting to that in a minute.
Sure.
Patty Blaine's here, also from A Meal and More. And Patty, why don't you remind our listeners what A Meal and More is?
A Meal and More is a soup kitchen at Christchurch on East Avenue. We feed anyone who comes to the door Wednesday and Sundays a hot, nutritious meal, middle of the day. And it's delicious stuff.
And you have grown the need has grown, hasn't it, in recent years?
I think it was 2014 we served over 10,000 meals.
Over 10,000 meals, yes.
It's gone down a little bit in the last couple, but it looks like it...
It's starting to rise again as summer comes. The need is more, and people are very confused. They think that during the winter we would get more people because of the cold weather. It works the complete opposite.
We get more families.
We get more families in the summertime because school is out, more children. During the winter, the elderly, which we have a large population, they don't come out during the winter.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Okay. Because I was reading that, you know, if you go back 5 years or so, you guys were doing 3,000 to 5,000 meals, and all of a sudden it kind of exploded in a few years.
It's very interesting because I was approached 5 years ago by the treasurer at the time, and he wanted to know if I wanted to become a board member. I said, sure.
Were you living in, were you here?
Yes.
Okay, you were here.
We moved here at the end of 2010.
Okay.
All right. And he approached me and asked if I wanted to become a board member, and I said, that would be great. He said, excellent. Your first job is to fire the chef and find a new one. I said, okay. So I thought about it, and I said, well, what about me? He said, that's what I was hoping you would say. And I just dove in. It was actually a very brand new experience for me. I mean, I come from restaurants. I worked in New York City for many years, and I was a chef in many restaurants. And this is a whole different bag of tricks. And it's very, people think, oh, it's easy. You're cooking one meal for a lot of people. It's not as easy as it seems. You have to think about cost. You have to think about how much to feed each person. You have to, there are so many small variables about working in a soup kitchen. And when we just hired our new chef about 4 months ago, one of the big questions we would ask people is, okay, talk to me. How would you, I would say to them, how many pounds of potatoes would you cook for 100 people? And they would look at me like, I have no idea. I said, well, this is one of the things you have to know. How many pounds of chicken? How many pounds of ground beef? Based on a recipe. And so luckily we found someone who had worked at one of the fraternities at the U of R. And what he did, he cooked three meals a day for 500, 600 guys. So luckily we found somebody.
And that was about 4 months ago, you said?
That was about 4 months ago, yes.
So was that the end of your cooking duties now?
What I do now is I manage the program. I do the menus. I sit down with the chef. We go through our inventory. I do all the ordering from FoodLink. What we do is we still do a lot of the recipes from the Book of Uncommon Recipes, which came out in 2014, they came to me. We hit a little snag financially at A Meal and More, and I said, you know what? I think I know how to raise some money. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to take all the recipes that from my childhood and that I've been making here, and I'm going to turn it into a recipe book. And luckily, from the grace of God, it worked. And we've raised almost $10,000 through the book.
Close to.
Yeah. And that has sustained us, and it still sustains us. And the book is still selling very well.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about two books in this conversation. Jeff mentioned the Book of Uncommon Recipes, 97 recipes from the kitchen of Emile and Moore. So that's one. And then we'll also be talking about Oi Italia, which is Jeff's story. It's Jeff's family history and some of the unusual family background and events in his life that inspired some of the recipes there. So two different books to talk about, but you can find them both. And while we're on the subject of the Book of Uncommon Recipes, Patty, can people still get copies of that now?
Yes, they can.
How do they do that?
They can go to our website, mealandmore.org, and there's a place to click and order it there. Or they can call up Christchurch.
Call Christchurch in Rochester?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so easy to find. And how significant is the financial crunch that Jeff was talking about? I mean, this is not the first charity that has faced hard financial times, but for what you have tried to do and what you do, serving more than 10,000 meals to people in need a year, how significant have the last few years been, Penny?
Funds are always an issue. We have somebody on the board who writes all of the grant proposals. We help her do that. We get food through Food Link through grants from the state and from Food Link itself. And there are also grants from the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester and some churches in the diocese. And we get some strong support from Rush United Methodist and North Chilliwack United Methodist churches too. That crunch, you know, we have a 40-some thousand-dollar budget, and we have a staff that we have to pay to feed people well and to feed them safely, to ensure that they are safe and to ensure that we're not damaging the church that we operate out of. And, you know, those are big costs.
Okay. Well, Jeff Caruso, retirement, this is not exactly how you might have figured you'd spend much of your retirement. but let me ask you then, having cooked in New York, in where else? In Philadelphia? Where?
Philadelphia and the Hudson Valley.
In the Hudson Valley.
Yes.
So having been in the restaurant world and then moving into charity in a soup kitchen, do you get more intrinsic value?
Absolutely.
You do?
I feel that I have something to give, and I can help others by doing it. It's that simple. And I'm very humble. People say you do such a wonderful job, and I say, you know, people are saying, you do this, you do that, and we come because of you. And I go, no, please don't come because of me. Come because you want to help us. You want to make a difference. I feel like I do make a difference, and I wake up every day and I say, thank God that I can do this.
Did you get intrinsic value in the restaurant industry?
No.
No?
Well,
there has to be some.
Okay, yes, I did.
I mean, it's got to be great for your ego. You know, I mean, you're making meals that people are paying good money for.
Yes, I worked in some wonderful places. You speak to any chef. They've had good experiences and very bad experiences.
Sure.
The good experiences were fabulous. The bad experiences were disastrous.
All right, hold on. Because you're a storyteller.
Yes, I am.
I'm going to interrupt and say, what's the worst restaurant night you can remember?
The worst restaurant night was actually a lunch. It was at a restaurant. I'm not going to give names or anything like that. No,
okay, okay.
No. Oh,
okay.
No. I know the deal here.
You can drop names on the good stories.
I can drop names on the good stories. But it was during a lunch hour, and it actually didn't have to do with anyone personally. And we had a very busy lunch. I remember that the dining room was full. There were people waiting. And all of a sudden, the grill caught fire. And off went all the alarms. Off went the sprays. The soap started coming down. The fire department showed up.
With customers there?
Oh, with customers
so
there.
They were getting
and
out
they
of
came
there.
Right through the front door. And they couldn't come in the back door because it's New York City. And they had to come. It was on East 86th Street. And here they come barreling through the door, and everyone's like, what's going on? And everyone obviously exited really quickly, and we had to close down for 3 days. And I felt personally responsible because I was cooking. But everybody said, you did nothing wrong. But that was the worst cooking disaster.
That was the worst cooking day you can remember.
Now, the worst disaster, I will not mention any names, but it was in Hudson, New York. I worked for a woman.
In the town of Hudson?
In the town of Hudson, which is
beautiful. I hear it is wonderful.
It is absolutely gorgeous. What it is, it's an artist's colony. And a lot of implants from New York City. Mm-hmm. People go up there to retire because it's only like 2.5 hours out of Manhattan. And I remember I was living in Manhattan, but I had an apartment in Hudson, and I used to commute back to Manhattan every week. I used to get, I had Sundays and Mondays off, so I'd get on the train at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and go back to Manhattan and then come back to do lunch on Wednesday. But I worked for a woman, and I remember seeing the ad in the New York Times, and it sounded really good. And I took the train up to Hudson, and she interviewed me, and she said, "You are my new chef." I said, and she also made a point of saying, "You are now the best paid chef in Hudson, New York." I said, "Okay, thank you." Well, I was there for 3 months. And then I come to find out I was the sixth that year, the sixth chef. At this restaurant. She was just a horror. She was a horror. But like I say, no names.
No names.
No names.
Okay.
But anyone who's...
And you were out after 3 months?
Oh, no. I quit.
Oh, you quit.
Oh, okay. I quit.
That's what I'm
saying.
Oh,
yeah. No, I quit. She was just unbearable.
In an industry in which unbearable is not all that uncommon, she was distinctly awful.
She was distinctly awful. Okay. And people just didn't like her. People did not like to work for her. But I did still enjoy the cooking. And I enjoyed the customers.
And you enjoyed Hudson, I imagine.
I loved Hudson.
Yeah,
I got another job right up the street mm-hmm. in a wonderful German restaurant, which was a lot of fun.
Okay, you see where I'm going with Jeff. We've got a lot of stories to tell. I'm about to work backwards if we could here. But I had to just sneak in those questions. And by the way, when you talk about sort of how negative that experience was working for someone who can be that, well, tough or negative, for lack of other words, in the industry, Jeff, I just read was reading Dan Barber's stuff. There's a lot of great chefs out there who will admit that they are on the neurotic side, that they can be tough or tyrants in the kitchen to their staff.
Yes.
But it's because they are driven. They have ridiculous standards, very high standards. Is that part of the industry, or do you occasionally come across a Jeff Caruso who's actually in a good mood most of the time?
Actually, I'm usually in a very good mood in the kitchen because my feeling is if my staff is happy, the food is going to be better. It makes the customers happy.
Yes. So how come so many of your colleagues in the industry are so hard-driving
and
tough?
And another story going back to that same restaurant on the Upper East Side. it's interesting. When I was hired with them, I was hired as the assistant chef. I had applied for a job about 4 months before, I remember, and had gotten the job. And then, unfortunately, something fell through and the restaurant did not open. Then about 3 months later, I got a call from this restaurant on 2nd Avenue saying, are you still looking for work? I said, sure. Well, we'd like you to come and join us. So I did. And it seems that the chef remembered me from the interviews from this other restaurant, and they had hired him as the chef, and I was going to be his assistant chef. Well, he was the typical chef that you read about, the tyrant. The problem is he was an alcoholic, and I hate to say it, there's a lot of alcohol in the food industry, and he would throw pots and pans around. He would throw knives around. Well, luckily for all of us, one Saturday night at the height of service, he was drinking as usual, and he went out and he insulted the boss's girlfriend. Now, my boss was a bodybuilder, okay? He literally took this guy, and he was like me. He was small. He literally took him by the scruff of the neck and threw him out the door right then and there. He came back. Said, "Come here, you." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, he shook my hand. He said, "You are now the new chef." Well, it's those kind of experiences that you learn from. You know, people say, "I went to culinary school and I worked for 4 years and I did this, this, this." And then they come out of culinary school and they expect to get a job as a chef. It doesn't work that way. I've always gone through the school of practical application. I started watching my mother and my two grandmothers cook, and that experience took me straight on through my career.
This is not dissimilar to the conversations we have with some teachers, particularly teachers in urban districts who tell you, yeah, I got a master's of education, but then you go into a school system and you got to learn how to deal with real life situations.
That's right.
And so just interesting parallels. My guest is Jeff Caruso. He is the chef and kitchen manager for Emile and More. Patty Blaine is here from Emile and More in Rochester. And there's two books out that you should know about. Jeff's story, which we're about to be getting into with a little more detail, is Oi Italia. And you can get that book wherever fine books are sold, right?
That's and what the Amazon, Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, as my publisher says, and where all fine books are sold.
Yeah, so Oi Italia has funny and sort of interesting stories of Jeff's family and history and how he was inspired by food throughout his life at a young age, and then a lot of recipes that kind of go with each in particular section. We'll be talking about that in a moment. The Book of Uncommon Recipes is from Emile and More, and it is 97 recipes from their kitchen there, and the proceeds there go to support Emile and More. Just interesting. And Patty, with Jeff's experience, I mean, the goal of a soup kitchen has to be number one, to be able to feed as many people as possible. It's probably a nice bonus when you can do so at a high level that has people talking, going, wait, that was a soup kitchen? I mean, like, nothing against soup kitchen, of course. But wow, I mean, you know, it's nice to make people say wow, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
And what have you seen in the last 5 years at Emile and More? People's reaction to Jeff and his personality and what he's been able to do there.
It's a welcoming place. I have to be honest, I was not associated with Emile and More even 5 years ago.
Okay.
So I became president in December. And before that, I was the volunteer coordinator. And I did both for a short while.
Which she was amazing.
So I can tell you, volunteers come into that kitchen. And Jeff is welcoming and gives them instruction, tells stories, even as they're working. And their work is fairly well-defined, which is great for a volunteer coming into a kitchen. People love working with him, for the most part. I've not had any complaints about that.
And they're serving meals, again, it's every Wednesday?
Every Wednesday and every Sunday. We open at Sunday and at noon or 11:30 on...
11:30 on Wednesdays.
Sorry. 11:30 Wednesdays, 1 o'clock on Sundays. And people are lined up out the door, even in horrible weather.
Yes.
It's at Christchurch?
Yep.
Which is where?
It's 141 East Avenue is the church address. The office address is 25 Broad Street. Broadway, sorry.
And the delivery address is 28 Lawn Street.
28 Lawn Street. And people line up outside the church parking lot door, which is off Lawn Street. Mm-hmm.
So more than 10,000 meals a year.
Usually, lately.
And now, I'm thinking, if you know somebody, you're not turning people away if they show up, if they're in need?
If they're in need and they're not inebriated, uh-huh. Yes, they come in. When weather's hot like this, we sometimes have altercations out front. We have to deal with that. But if they're in need and they don't have to present their level of need, they just sign in. We do that for Food Link records. And we don't know, maybe they have food, maybe they don't. We also have GNS Orchards. At this time of year, a woman comes from there. Her name is escaping me. Sorry.
Stephanie.
Stephanie
Kraft.
Comes on Sundays and delivers produce, and we put that on tables for people to pick up on their way out.
That's very nice.
Yeah. So it's fresh produce, and she started just a couple weeks ago, and we will be having that probably right through November.
Through November, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, Jeff, your own interest in cooking goes back to... Can we go back to the Tobacco Sisters? I mean, you go back to 1916?
I assume that it was before 1916. All I know is, from my family history, that the Caruso brothers, my grandfather and his brother, married the Tobacco Sisters in a small village in Sicily, which I found very strange.
Brothers marrying sisters.
Marrying sisters, but I have come to find out since then, this was the norm back then.
Okay.
And they got on a boat in 1916 and headed for Ellis Island. My grandmother at the time was pregnant with my father. So when they hit, he did I've heard the story. I've heard such conflicting stories. I've heard that she gave birth on the boat. I heard that she gave birth when she got here. He still was an American citizen.
Right, so the bottom line is whether he was born on Ellis Island, on the boat, wherever, was an American citizen.
He was an American citizen. And they started a life here. And they lived in the Bronx. And it was funny because as I was sitting outside, I was thinking how funny how my mother and father got together. My mother was born in Washington Heights, 1921. She was born and raised in New York City, just as my father was. And to a Jewish parents, and of course my father had Sicilian parents. But my mother lived in an Italian neighborhood, and all of her girlfriends were Italian and Catholic. And she would go to Novena. Now, I don't know if you know what Novena, what they used to do in the Catholic religion on Wednesdays. It's a prayer. It's like, I guess it's like a Bible study. Okay. And they come on Wednesday nights and they go through and they pray. And my mother used to go to these novenas with all her girlfriends. Now, I would have to say my grandparents were not very religious Jews, although that they did celebrate the holidays, but they were not Orthodox by any means. My mother's brother married into an Orthodox family, and that's when I started to really learn about the culture of the Jewish religion. But my mother, at the time that she met my father, was engaged. And her younger brother, who was a bit younger than her, there was a radio store in the building that they lived, and my father and his cousin owned it. And my uncle used to go and talk to them, and he said, thought, gee, this guy's really nice. I'm going to introduce him to my sister. Now, I just said, my mother was engaged at the time. Well, she met him, and the rest is history. She married him. And it did cause a little rift in the family, okay? It's not in the book. Well, it sort of is in the book, because my grandfather was very, very strict Sicilian. Extremely strict. Wonderful guy, but you don't marry out of your culture. And my father, and he was the oldest, so he was the first. My father had five brothers and sisters. Okay, so he was one of five. And he, right off the bat, he married a Jew. So it didn't go over very well. I mean, my grandfather got along. You know, my grandmother, God rest her soul, was the sweetest, most loving woman in the world. And she just embraced my mother and taught her everything that she knew. And that was another problem, because my mother and all her daughters had a cook. My mother turned out to be the best cook out of all of them. So that didn't go over very well.
You mean for Sicilians,
yes,
Italians?
My aunts were good cooks, but my mother was the better cook. She was the better cook.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
and hold on, important point of distinction here. You know, you talk about Sicilian, Italian. Look, when I was in Italy in 2008, I remember we were in the town of Lucca. We're riding bikes around the ramparts, and this group of nice older women came over and said, "Can you take our picture?" I said, "Sure." I said, "I love Italian women." And they looked at me and scowled. They said, "We are not Italian.
We
are
Sicilian."
Sicilian.
I know.
And I thought, wow.
It's still like that. It still is like that. So people, when I say I'm Sicilian, they go, "Okay, yes, you're Sicilian." I go, "No, I'm American."
Okay.
See, I always, that's how I get out of it.
But you can say you're Italian too, right? I mean,
of
course.
Exactly, because
you're not going to offend your own family?
Of course not. I'm not going to offend my family, but when my grandparents came over here, they moved into an Italian neighborhood, which had Sicilians in it. And of course, like, New York City was the melting pot. You know, everybody got along.
But the Italian-Sicilian side, they won at least on how you were raised. You were raised Roman Catholic, right?
Yes. My grandfather insisted upon that. Okay. I do remember that. He said, no, they will be raised Roman Catholic. And like I said, my mother and her family were not very religious. They didn't care.
Okay.
They didn't really care.
So that part wasn't as controversial as maybe your mother besting everyone in the kitchen.
No, it wasn't. But then I got kicked out of Catholic school. I did during the first Holy Communion, which is one of the stories called Excommunicated. We were walking out from the school to the church, It was a very cloudy day. I remembered it looked like it was going to rain. And there were all these thousands of people standing outside the church. And, of course, we were single file. And the sisters made sure heads straight ahead, don't falter. And somebody called out my name. It was probably one of my relatives, and I turned and I waved. And the next thing I knew, she took her umbrella and whacked me in the rear. I was so stunned, I didn't know what to do. My reaction was, I grabbed it and hit her back.
And that was that?
That was that. Monday morning, we had to go to the Mother Superior. And you know, Sister Patricia, I still remember her to this day. I got along very well with Sister Patricia, and I was in her office a lot. I was. And she really liked me, but finally she called my parents and she said, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Caruso, I really don't think Catholic school is the right thing for Jeff. My mother was appalled. Oh my goodness, my son is going to get kicked out. My father, I come to find out, he was also kicked out of Catholic school for doing the exact same thing. He was beaming.
He was beaming. Your Jewish mother was appalled you're getting kicked out of Catholic school.
Yes, and my father was beaming because there's my boy.
Let's get to the only break of the hour, and we're right back with Chef Jeff Caruso. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we talked to RBTL Chairman Arnie Rothschild about plans for a new large theater downtown in Rochester. A new study claims it would not need ongoing taxpayer subsidy. Should we believe it? Then in our second hour, a Hobart professor has a new book called Monstrous Progeny, a history of the Frankenstein narratives. Talk with you Friday. Let's talk a little bit how the book is structured, because the book's called Oi Italia by Jeff Caruso. You can find it now. And Jeff structures it in a way that he tells you a story, a short story, a page or two, but a story that stands out from his memory, from his childhood, from his upbringing. And that story is the frame for then the next set of recipes. And so there's usually a theme. So, for example, can you tell me the pressure cooker incident?
The pressure cooker incident, yes. That's a good one. Oh, I must have been about 7 or 8 years old. And it must have been a holiday because my mother was home because she did work full time. She invited her girlfriends over, the neighborhood coffee klatch. The ladies were coffee klatching. And my brother wasn't there. See, my brother is 7 years older than me. So at that time, he may have already been off to college. No, he couldn't have been off to college. He was probably like a junior or senior in high school. So he was off with his friends, whatever. And my mother decided to make split pea soup, which was one of her better soups there. And she put it in the pressure cooker. And the ladies were inside clutching away. And I was sitting watching TV. And all of a sudden, I heard this rumble. And then bang! And I ran to the kitchen, and the entire kitchen was engulfed in split pea soup. The pressure cooker had just exploded, and there were all her girlfriends covered from head to toe in split pea soup. My mother was like, my mother got appalled at the slightest thing. She was, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And they laughed hysterically, and they all just mopped it up and went about their merry way, but we had pizza that night.
So that set of recipes is, so for example.
The soups. That's where all the soups come from.
So there's your soups, there's your story for the soups. I just choosing a few. The explosive temper you saw at the midweek pasta. Your mother apparently.
Oh.
Apparently, your mother apparently threw a curveball
right.
For dinner one night.
Right, that one is called Ragu. Okay, and I had asked specifically. I asked the lawyers before I wrote a lot of these stories about mentioning product names, and they said if you're going to use them in a negative light,
yes,
don't use them. If you're going to use them in a positive,
you've really disguised Ragu very cleverly.
Well, but the point is, I can't be sued for it. I cannot, and. My father.
Well, hold on. So back it up here, because your mother typically made what for
my mother pasta? made everything from scratch. She always made her own sauce, but she was a consumer in the 60s, a housewife, and new products come out, so she bought this new kind of sauce. And dinner came. We sat down to dinner. She put out the plates of pasta. We all sat down. So it was me, my mother, my father, and our dog, our little beagle, Abigail. And we're sitting down, and my mother puts, like I said, puts the pasta in front of us. The smell, something. I said something's not right here. My father sniffed it, looked at my mother, snipped it, looked at my mother, and said, "What the hell is this?" She said, "Well, you know, it's this new..." He calmly got up, he went to the back door, he opened it, and he threw the plate out the door and started ranting in Sicilian and saying things that I cannot say on this radio program, okay? And the dog flew out of the room, and he said to me, "Go walk the dog.
Go walk the dog.
And I did.
We must talk about the sauce.
Right. And I came back, and my father was there. I said, "Where's Mom?" "She went to bed. She had a headache." I said, "Okay." And I saw all the plates were in the sink. I saw the pot with the sauce was in the sink, and he was rinsing it out. I said, "Oh, we're not going to have any dinner?" He said, "Yeah, we're going to have dinner. Sit down." My father's favorite meal was sardines. I didn't like sardines. But that night, he and I had sardines and bread and hot peppers, my grandfather's hot peppers, which is another part of that
story. I was going to ask you about that, but at least you had something with the sardines. So I guess the lesson there was, boy, Sicilians, those of Italian heritage, when they lock into a recipe and the pride of making something from scratch, you don't like to deviate.
No, you do not deviate, especially with something out of a jar. And I had noticed, and he even had mentioned to me later, he rifled through the garbage and he found the jar all the way at the bottom of the garbage pail. So she hid it. She sort of knew in advance maybe she could pull this off, but no, it didn't happen.
So that section of recipes in the book is?
Oh, there's that section of recipes.
So look, I'm quizzing Jeff on his own book.
I know, and
now
I
you're rifling through.
You stinker, you. Okay, these are recipes for weeknights.
Yeah, weeknight
recipes, which are not hard.
Potato gnocchi with roasted garlic, red pepper, and basil cream sauce is one. Chicken thighs stuffed with ricotta and herbs, Italian pork chops, roasted garlic, red pepper. There you go. So anyway, you break down the components. And pork milanese, eggplant parm. So, okay, so it's midweek recipes.
Right, all midweek recipes, exactly.
Well, you mentioned the peppers. We might as well tell that story.
Because the peppers, my grandfather.
The hot pepper. I have to ask you, were people actually crying?
Yes, they were.
Okay, so
yes, they were.
Yeah, you have to tell us why they were crying.
Well, my grandfather was a great gardener, and he had a little garden, and he grew his tomatoes, and he grew his peppers, and he grew his eggplants, and he grew his zucchinis. But one of his things that he loved was they're called the Italian hot frying peppers, okay? And you can still get them here. I get them in Wegmans all the time. They actually do have them. They're sort of curled up. You can find them in the pepper section. And this was like a staple in our family. You would have it with a sandwich. You would have it as a side. You would just sit down and eat it. But boy, were they hot. And he used to cook these peppers at least once or twice a month. And they lived in this little complex, which was, you know, it was like an adult complex. But I do remember there were young people because there were a lot of kids there. And my grandmother told me that the neighbors used to come over and they really liked the peppers. And they used to line up outside the door on the days that he was making these peppers. And the tears were coming down their eyes. And I said, "What is it?" Because I was so used to this. They were so hot that the fumes would bring tears to your eyes, literally. And my grandmother would greet them at the door and she would take their little Tupperware and she would fill it up. And they would walk out the door, still with the tears streaming down their eyes. But that's the way it was, but they were hot.
Were you the kind of family that, from a young age, you were just conditioned to eat heavy spice, heat, etc.?
Yes, and I'm not really one to eat a lot of spice, but those peppers, since I was brought up on them, those are the only hot peppers that I can eat. You give me a Mexican pepper or a chipotle pepper, I can't eat them.
Oh,
I cannot eat them. They're just too spicy for me. But you give me an Italian frying pepper, I have no problem with it. I wonder if it's mind over matter.
It's probably that. And you know, it's sort of in your DNA now.
I think
or at
that's
least,
exactly what it is.
Or in your nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia.
You know, so many people have these stories that they remember. And I think that's what Jeff's book, I mean, it is particularly colorful. But, you know, what is so relatable is we can probably all think of something that we remember eating growing up, a staple dish, et cetera. Jeff, is there one favorite for you? I mean, if you go back, is there one classic that your mother or family made that you love more than others?
I think it would have to be lasagna. And I've adapted my own lasagna recipes. But people do ask me, what's my personal best recipe? And I would have to say it's my bolognese. And it's not your classic bolognese, because most bolognese, it is still three separate meats. And that's exactly what bolognese is. It's three separate meats, but it's chopped, okay? I don't do it that way. I go out and I buy pork shoulder. I cut it up in chunks. I buy stewing beef. I cut that up in chunks. And I buy hot and sweet sausage and cut that up in chunks. And then put all the ingredients in a pot and put it in the oven for like 4 hours. Okay, so that's not the way it's traditionally made at all. But when I was working in Hudson, someone reviewed it and said it was the best bolognese along the Hudson. So I'm not going to argue with that. Okay?
So, and you know, earlier I asked in your restaurant career, what were the darkest moments? Well, now, tell me either the most pride, maybe in a recipe you created or the way you were able to incorporate that family tradition that you're talking about and took it in to the restaurants that you worked with, and then you thought, this is it. This is the best. What is the best memory you have?
The best memories were when I made sauce the very first time in the very first restaurant. And the boss came in and said, that smells pretty good. What is this? And I said, well, this is my old family recipe. And he tasted it. I sat him down and made him a plate of pasta, gave him a couple of meatballs, gave him some sausage, gave him some brajol. He said, this is it. This is on the menu. This is going to be our feature dish. That really made me feel good. It really did.
Talking to Jeff Caruso, whose book is Oi Italia. That's where you can find the recipes he's been describing in the last few minutes here. You can also find the Book of Uncommon Recipes. It's a separate book, shorter, really easy to navigate. 97 recipes from the kitchen of A Meal and More. And that is where Jeff is chef and kitchen manager. We've also been talking to Patty Blaine from A Meal and More. They serve roughly 10,000 meals a year to people in need in Rochester. It's a soup kitchen, and they are doing the work to make sure people who don't have meals and have that need, for that need to be filled. So we've been talking about your experience there, and I also want to ask you about culinary traditions in that. I remember when we talked to Lydia Bastianich, and we were talking about...
My favorite. I love Lydia.
Yeah,
in fact,
I sent
her a copy of this because she was sort of an inspiration for this book. I remember after I had written it, I was trying to tie it together, and I didn't know how I was going to tie it together. And I was sitting watching Saturday morning, noon, WXXI, and she was doing one of her recipes, and she said, it's all about the family. And that did it. It clicked right in my head. That's how I'm going to bring this book together. So when it came out, I took a chance. I went onto her website, and I found an address, and I typed in, I said, I'd like to send Lydia a copy of my book, and blah, 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 blah. And her assistant got in touch with me. And I think they sort of misinterpreted what I had written. She said, well, Lydia doesn't really take solicitations for books.
Sure.
I understand that, but this book has already been published. And she was sort of an inspiration. Oh, I'm sorry. Please do send it to us. And she sent me a little nice note saying, thank you very much. It was so enjoyable.
Well, she's a genuinely warm woman.
Yes, she is.
You know, because anytime you see someone on television, and there are other channels besides WXXI TV, I think, but regardless, wherever you see someone, you know, you meet them in person, in real life, so to speak, and you don't know what you're going to get. And I found her to be so genuinely warm.
Yes.
And I was also blown away with just how thoughtful and almost encyclopedic she was about culinary traditions across Italy and the way they translate. And here's where I'm going with this, Jeff, because I want to get your take on this. Mm-hmm. I had asked Lydia about something that kind of, I don't want to say annoyed me, but I guess it kind of bothered me. I was talking to someone in this town, I won't name names either, see?
There you go.
We'll keep with the tradition, who's worked in quote-unquote Italian cooking for a long time. Mm-hmm. And this person had come out with their own quote-unquote Italian cookbook. But I said, you know, a lot of it is sort of spaghetti and meatball basic what Americans think of as Italian, but when you go to Italy, it's a lot more complex and interesting than that. And this person told me, well, you know, you have to make money. Americans have expectations. You know, certain things don't really translate. And I thought that was a little venal. What Lydia said, she kind of split the difference in a way that I thought was really thoughtful. She said, look, when immigrants came here, they came with their traditions, the way your family did, right?
Absolutely.
So they came with their traditions, they came with their history, they came with the recipes they loved, and they tried to find everything. They tried to grow everything and find everything so they could recreate it. And they couldn't always find everything. And in those moments, sometimes you had to be creative. And you fuse what you could find with what you could find here that you hadn't used before. And sometimes that fusion, you create something new, sort of an Italian-American. But sometimes that's an organic process. The way food travels, that's different than just saying Italian equals spaghetti and meatballs. You know, so I thought that was a very interesting answer, and I'm curious to know your take on that.
Well, what I would say to that gentleman is you shouldn't be in this business. I'm sorry. I think people who cook have a passion. I don't think this person has a passion for their craft, if it even is a craft to them. You said the magic words, money. Yes, of course you want to make money, but you know what? You want to make money, but you also want people to be happy. You want to bring your culture. You want to bring your experiences to the table. And that's what Lydia does. That's what I do. That's what people do. And I'm not just talking about Italians. I'm talking about all cultures. Even with my Jewish grandmother, the same thing. It was a passion, her recipes. And yes, same thing. You have to adapt. There are many things. Well, now that's sort of different because now you can get anything. Anything.
It's amazing what you can get.
Yes.
What can't you get that you would love to get?
Oh, gosh. That's a hard one. Evan, that's a hard one.
What about 15, 20 years ago? What couldn't you get that now you can get more?
What couldn't you get? Believe it or not, you couldn't get fresh herbs. That was probably one of the hardest things to get here was fresh herbs. Not just Italian herbs, or you really couldn't get good olive oil.
Oh, well, yeah.
Oh, good olive oil is probably the key to
it. Ruins it, Jeff. You go to Italy, you have olive oil, and you go, "What? I don't want olive oil in the United States."
Well, and
anymore.
You know, it's very funny.
It's so good.
The New York Times did an article, I think it was a couple of years ago, specifically on olive oils and imported olive oils. And they said most of them are not imported. You have to go to a specialty store, and a specialty Italian market to really get good olive oil. And it's funny because I do most of my shopping in Wegmans like everybody else does. But every once in a while, I will go to these specialty stores, a small store. And yes, it's a little bit more expensive, but boy, it makes a difference.
Yeah,
it makes a big difference.
I was amazed at the aromatics of olive oil when you're there. You know, you're in Tuscany. I mean, this is like the ultimate privilege conversation. I get it. I mean, just the aromatics, how fruity it can be, how earthy it can be, and how we don't, I just, you know, growing up here, you don't really experience
it.
No,
you don't. And it's very funny because my other half, I love him dearly. And when we go out to Italian, we don't go to many Italian restaurants in Rochester because, you know, we get it. He says, I get it at home and it's good. But when we do go to the few that are really good here and they put the bread and the olive oil on the table, excuse me, can I have some butter? I go, Michael, why do you do this? It's just him. And I enjoy just sitting there and taking some little bit of cracked pepper, putting it on it and dipping it in it because it's just, there's nothing like it. There is nothing like good olive oil.
Well, we got a few more minutes with Jeff Caruso and Patty Blaine from A Meal and More talking about Jeff's book and the work that he has done throughout his career now for A Meal and More. And I want to wrap the conversation as we talk about food, about the need in our community. So, Patty, right now, you guys are you the oldest food kitchen in Russia? Are you the biggest? I'm trying to get a sense for your place on the scene.
I think we're the oldest. We've been around since 1979.
Okay. And how would you describe the need in our community, the need for hot meals? You do it twice a week there. You do 10,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
What's the need in this community?
Deep and wide. It seems to be bottomless. It seems to be growing, and we see some of the same people every week, twice a week, and we see new people, kids, often.
See kids often.
Yeah.
Is that the hardest?
Yeah. Well, for me, but I'm coming to it. I came to this program after tutoring at school number 9 for a few years. I ran a tutoring program there for St. Paul's Episcopal Church for 3.5 years. And so I saw the need in the school and you know, worried about kids' food over the weekends and over school breaks, and to see them show up with grandfathers on or grandmothers on a Sunday or during the summer. It's kind of heartbreaking that we have that much hunger, food insecurity here in the city.
Jeff, what's the hardest for you?
I think the hardest for me, excuse me, is like Patty said, the little kids and the elderly. Mm. The elderly. And it amazes me how desperate that they really are, because sometimes no matter, even though I did say that during the winter they don't come out as much, they still do. If they're hungry, they will go wherever the need brings them. And some of them have walkers, are in wheelchairs, crutches, and they come for that meal. And my heart goes out to them. My heart goes out to all of our guests, because they are in need. But I also know that there are a lot of people that come to our soup kitchen who, somebody once asked me, what is your homeless rate? And I would have to say our homeless rate is probably less than 2%. Mm-hmm. Most of these people.
The homeless rate of the people who come
yes,
to see.
Yes, most of them are domiciled. But again, like Patty said, we don't turn anybody away. We will never turn anybody away. I have never turned anybody away, but I have to tell this story. I'm sorry. When I, about 4 months after I started there, word had gotten out that the soup kitchen is serving not soup kitchen meals, okay? And we started getting a lot of suits, okay? When the building across the Bank of America building, excuse me, I remember one day a group came in, 4 gentlemen and 3 women. They were all dressed very well. The men had on suits, the women had on skirts, blouses, jewelry, dripping in jewelry. And I said, hey guys, what's up? I said, we'd like to eat. I said, great. I'm not going to deny you a meal, but I'm going to ask you for a donation. No problem. Except for one woman. And the one who was dressed in the Dior and the Gucci, she got out, walked out in a huff, which I thought interesting. But they had no problem. They just threw $20 bills at me and ate their meal.
Do you remember what they were eating that day?
I think I made chicken cordon bleu with a sherry cream sauce. Well, you know, I went down to the freezers when I first got there, and there was chicken breast, and there was ham, and there was cheese. I said, well, you know, it's a no-brainer. You make chicken cordon bleu. And that's what I did. But of course, word got out that there's a soup kitchen that's serving chicken cordon bleu, and they're serving, oh gosh, I can't even remember what other meals. I just did what I do. I did what I do. And I take what I had. And luckily, there was a lot of things there that had never been touched, I noticed, that I think were just ordered, and the person just didn't know what to do with them. And of course, we went through and threw out what was past due, but there was a lot of good food there. And so I made it into even better food.
Jeff is very good at making silk purses out of sow's ears, literally, because we don't get the cream of the crop from Food Link or from we get what doesn't look good on the shelf often, and he can go in and see what's there, and okay, we're having this and this, and it's going to be excellent food. And it is.
And frankly, as a culture, we waste too much food anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, one bruise on an apple or, you know, one sort of, it doesn't take much for us to discard food that is still very good. You're nodding.
Oh, it's.
And
it's,
Food Link's warehouse is full of, I mean, it's just, it's eye-opening if you ever have a chance to tour it. It's.
What do you think, Jeff?
Patty is so right. We are so wasteful. I mean, in this country, but even here in Rochester. But another experience quickly that I had, I worked for a very posh catering company in Scarsdale, New York, many years ago. And at the end of the day, they would literally throw away pies, pastries, produce, sandwiches. They would just take it out to the dumpster. And I said to them once, why don't you give this away to charity? Give it to the homeless. We don't do that. This was Scarsdale, New York. Need I say more? I was appalled. They wasted pounds. They wouldn't even give it to the employees to take home.
Well, a meal and more is the opposite of that mentality.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank Jeff and Patty for the work that you and the staff do, and for all the people who help feed people in need in our community. This is such important work. You can find the Book of Uncommon Recipes, From Our Soup Kitchen to Your Table, 97 recipes from the kitchen of A Meal and More. You can find it now. Patty, where do you find it?
Christchurch. Want a phone number?
Go ahead.
454-3878, area code 585.
Okay, but Christchurch, Rochester, that's where you find it, and the proceeds go to support A Meal and More.
Yes, they do.
And very important, as we've been discussing, because they've been crunched just like just about everybody else in the last few years. You can find Jeff Caruso's book, Oi Italia, not only some vignettes from his family, colorful family history, but many more recipes from Jeff. Jeff, you can find that where?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all fine booksellers.
They have it drilled into you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you, Evan.
This conversation has been part of our Summer of Food series of discussions about the food scene in Rochester and the Finger Lakes. And you can find previous Summer of Food conversations on the Connections podcast page. Easy to find there at wxxinews.org/connections. My thanks to engineer Rob Braden, intern Deprina Godboldo, and producer Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we will talk with you on Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.